Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the line lengthens for those waiting to take Richard Burr's U.S. Senate seat as former Charlotte Mayor and Governor Pat McCrory enters the race. The city manager finds a way to increase funding for the arts, but details of exactly how much control the city would exert over programming remains a bit unclear. CMS renames a school and makes air quality improvements to others. They also announce in-person graduation ceremonies this spring. And North Carolina voting laws are back in court. Swindler Bernie Madoff dies in a North Carolina prison, and the legislature debates permanent daylight savings time. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison. Good morning, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Morning. Joe Bruno is back with us from WSOC TV Channel 9. Good morning.
Hello, Mike.
Jonathan Lowe triumphantly returns from Spectrum News 1, where he is a reporter anchor. Hello there.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And Mary C. Curtis writes for RollCall.com, hosts their Equal Time podcast, and contributes to WCCB-TV. And she still has time to be with us this morning. Good morning.
Of course. And hello, Mike.
Welcome. Well, as I said, the list of people running to fill North Carolina Senator Richard Burr's seat grew longer this week. Former Charlotte mayor and former Governor Pat McCrory threw his hat into the ring. He's been out of politics officially, but not really, because he's been talking about it for a long time, spending that time talking about it on the radio. And here's what he told his WBT audience about why he's running.
There's a calling that I have. My dad told me, fulfill your potential. Fulfill your potential where you can make the biggest difference to leave this place a better place than when we arrived. As a city council member, as a mayor, as a governor, and as a radio host, I think we have fulfilled our potential. And we've brought a unique voice to help the dialogue and to help the quality of life and to help with problem solving that we desperately need in Washington now more than ever. So let me just tell my family, my audience, my friends, I'm in. I'm going to run for the U.S. Senate.
He told his family on the radio? Did this come as a surprise to anybody but his family, I guess, is the question, Steve.
No, there was no surprise here. Everyone knew he was going to announce. I think his website even went live that morning before he announced on WBT. I think, we were talking about this before we went on, that he's kind of labeling himself as an outsider, which is a bit ridiculous when you're a former governor, only a little more than 4 years removed from serving. But at the same time, there is a bit of truth in that statement, calling himself an outsider. Because remember, his time as governor, he just kind of wasn't at the cool kids table. There were a lot of the Republicans in the legislature kind of blew him off and that did not consider him really an integral part of their supermajority. So I think a big interesting thing will be him having been out of the game for 4 years and what will become 6 years before the election, how relevant, how can he speak to the Republican base?
He joins U.S. Representative Mark Walker, another Republican, as one of the top tier candidates among Republicans. U.S. Representative Ted Budd is considering a run, as is North Carolina's Laura Trump. She's, of course, the daughter-in-law of the former president. Does McCrory, outside of Laura Trump, have the biggest name recognition of those Republicans and those Democrats who have thrown their hat into the ring?
Well, that is an advantage. He does have great name recognition as a longtime mayor, as a former governor. But the part of it is who is Pat McCrory? Because, of course, he made his name as being this moderate Republican, a mayor of Charlotte. But then the party has changed. And he changed too. He's has a name recognition for being the governor during HB2, the so-called bathroom bill that brought a lot of boycotts to the state, a lot of notoriety. Also the first voter bill, the one that was actually thrown out in federal court. And I think it's evidence that the Republican Party is the party of Trump now. because to listen to Pratt McCrory now, he sounds very much, you know, with the mantra of cancel culture, that is the new face of the Republican Party. So he has that name recognition, which is a positive thing, but also his name brings some negatives.
And go ahead, Jonathan.
I was going to add, you know, people who know Pat McCrory and know a little bit about his history, even if you don't remember as far back as him being mayor, probably are wondering what's different. Is there anything different? And through this last year, at least, you know, the couple of times that I've interviewed him, specifically back when his staff was directly impacted by COVID, he talked about it a lot on the radio. This was when we were having the whole discussion and protests last summer to reopen North Carolina. It's when, you know, we initially started seeing masks being politicized, and someone on his staff, very close to him, died of COVID. It was one of the very first deaths that we saw in our area. And I talked to him soon after that, Mike, and it was clear that that had impacted him in a personal way. Mm. And he took that on air, and he was very, he was saying something that was completely different from what the rest of the Republican Party was saying at that time about COVID, about it being real, not being a hoax. So people should know that and wondering if there's any different Pat McCrory this time around.
Well, we're going to play a clip from his campaign video that may indicate that the shift has not been that dramatic. We'll do that in a second. Joe?
I'm just interested to see if he will become the establishment candidate, because he does have the best name recognition of the candidates that are in the field right now. I think Ms. Trump is the one wild card that is out there, and she would probably become one of the favorites if she jumped into this race. And I think that Mark Robinson, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, is also another wild card who is incredibly popular in the Republican Party. So I wonder if Mr. McCrory will just see tons of money thrown his way. He'll try to solidify himself as the establishment candidate.
I was just going to say, Mike, just kind of off what Joe said, talking about the lieutenant governor, I think Mark Robinson is able to speak to Republicans in a way that he's made a real deep connection in such a short time in office. You know, very combative with the media. The Republican base loves that. I think he's got a lot of energy and a lot of potential in this race to kind of shake things up. So I think he's someone to keep their eye on.
So name recognition.
He's a culture warrior, but it'll be a test of North Carolina. What kind of state are we? Are we a true red Trump state? They want that red meat, or do they find him coming in a little hot? It'll be interesting to see.
So name recognition aside, on his last radio program, which was this week, McCrory summed up his decision to run this way.
Of all the candidates that are considering to run for the U.S. Senate, Republican and Democrat, I am the best for this job. And if I wasn't, I wouldn't run. I'm the best for this job because I've done it. I fulfilled my promises. Every step I've taken, I fulfilled my promises as a city council member, as a mayor, as a governor, and right here, even in media. I've been transparent. I've been honest. I've been direct, and I plan to do just that as the next U.S. Senator representing North Carolina.
Is it my imagination, or does he sound a little bit defensive there? Earlier in that announcement, he railed against the radical left, that's his words, that has taken control in Washington. He talked about the radical policies of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and President Biden and Vice President Harris, and he talked about how they were opening our borders and closing our schools. Most Americans seem to like the president's policies so far. His approval ratings are higher than most contemporary presidents have been at this stage of the game. Is this message going to resonate?
It's going to resonate for now. He needs to get through the Republican primary. I asked him, what separates you from the other Republicans who are running and thinking about running? And he had a similar line. This is a direct quote. He said, quote, I'm going to quote Tina Turner and say, I'm simply the best for the job. And, you know, the other thing I asked, well, if you remember when Politico had the first article about Pat McCrory coming into this race, Mark Walker put out a torching statement saying Pat's lost more statewide races than he's won, and that if he isn't good enough for the Trump administration, he isn't good enough for North Carolina. Wow. And is this how this race is going to be? And he said that he is not going to be on the offensive with the Republican candidates in the field. He's going to focus on the Bidens and the Harrises and the Schumers, like you just mentioned,
Mike. And we just heard him say that in his political and radio life, he has been transparent and honest. But in a video he released concurrent with his announcing for his campaign, he painted a picture of a nation in crisis. Here's just a portion of that.
The United States Senate is split right down the middle, 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats. And that puts Vice President Kamala Harris in charge, giving the left everything they want to radically change America for generations to come. And it's happening right now. Harris and Biden are opening our borders before they even open up our schools. They're raising your taxes and even the price of gas.
How much of that is true?
You know, when it comes to the opening borders part, you know, I hope people are not forgetful that this is a problem that goes back to the Obama administration. As far as the issues with migrants from Central America coming up to the border issues along not just the Texas border, but Arizona. I lived in Arizona for a while. And I specifically remember during the Obama administration when they were bringing busloads of migrants that were coming to the border that they couldn't, the border was overwhelmed, and then they were just bringing them to major cities and they were fanning out from there, trying to find services. So this is not a new issue. This is not a new problem. And I hope people remember that, you know, when they hear that statement, that they know right off that that's not true.
So I'm also not surprised that he mentioned Kamala Harris, the vice president, a woman, a Black woman of South Asian descent, the daughter of immigrants, as the face of look who's in charge. This is, you know, and then, of course, throwing Nancy Pelosi in there for a good measure. You say, is this the new him? Well, actually, it is now the playbook for the Republican Party, like it or not.
So what has been the reaction to his announcement among state Republicans, Steve?
I mean, you know, I think Joe summed it up best when he talked about Mark Walker, even before the official announcement, immediately, you know, attacking McCrory as kind of a has-been, in Mark Walker's words. You know, I think everyone's still kind of waiting to see how the field settles out. Ted Budd is another candidate who's likely to get in a congressman. Ted Budd, I think, kind of occupies the same space as Mark Walker, very, very conservative, very pro-Trump. So I'm not sure how those two are going to distinguish themselves in a primary. I think McCrory, I think just a big thing to watch with him will be, you know, how important Trump is today in the party and how McCrory can kind of, you know, the big vote on the election, on certifying the election, that Mark Walker and Ted Budd voted against that. I think, you know, how will McCrory explain that? What is his position?
Joe, just under 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I think McCrory will be a contender right until the primary because of his name recognition and the money he will be able to raise.
Joe Bruno with Channel 9, WSSC-TV, Jonathan Lois here from Spectrum News Run, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. When we come back, City Council news, the arts, affordable housing, and more. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Mary C. Curtis, Steve Harrison, Joe Bruno, and Jonathan Lowe. A few weeks ago, City Council began talking about taking control of its yearly monetary support for arts in Charlotte by bypassing the Arts and Science Council and creating its own funding mechanism. I think they last gave the ASC, the Arts and Science Council, $3.2 million, and they initially said that they could increase that funding by doing it directly to $4 million. But this week, City Manager Marcus Jones presented a plan to council in which he revealed that he was unable to enlist the support of private enterprise, asking them for an equal amount of money, an equal $4 million. That would have led it to raised it to $8 million, but the private sector said, no, that's not enough. We need to give $6 million, and so do you. So now that raises it to $12 million. Does the city have the means to do $6 million?
They do. In addition to that $4 million you talked about, they're going to throw in another $2 million from the federal COVID relief money.
But that money is temporary. It goes away eventually. So what then?
Well, I mean, I think they've identified the $2 million for the next 3 years.
Okay.
But, you know, I think it's important. $2 million, the general fund is probably going to be over $600 million, $650 million in that time. It's very doable to find that piece of money. And I think the city wanted to make a big splash and, you know, show like, look at what financial heft and strength we're bringing to this plan.
There are a lot of questions surrounding the mechanism being suggested to administer this money. Marcus Jones, the city manager, suggests a temporary arts commissioner be chosen along with a board comprised of members from the business community, city government, and others who play a role, and then the money would be administered or distributed by the Foundation for the Carolinas. I had Mayor Pro Tem Julie Isolde on the program earlier this week, along with District 2 City Councilman Malcolm Graham, talking about this and other city business, and I could not figure out the structure. Mary, I know you were listening, so could you?
Thanks a lot, Mike.
You're welcome.
Well, they basically said they're going to have the money wouldn't go directly to the Arts and Science Council. They're going to have the Foundation for the Carolinas distributed for at least a year. Then they're going to have a new Arts and Culture Commissioner. Then they're going to create an advisory board to decide how the money is spent. It's a little bit complicated. And the foundation, Yeah.
Because on the one hand, they kept saying that they would not be controlling the money or how it was distributed. It would be controlled by a third party. On the other hand, they say they will be controlling the money because, after all, it is taxpayer money. And that raises an important question. Tell me how you're going to keep politics out of it now.
Because how can you? How can you, Mike? If we're the funders, if we're responsible for funding affordable housing, how do you keep us out of affordable housing? Should we be out of that? If we're being expected to bring millions of dollars to the table, don't we have a taxpayer responsibility to make sure it's being spent in a way that benefits the people? We do have that responsibility. You know, in no scenario would the public agree to us writing taxpayer checks and handing it over to people and say, good luck, I hope it goes well.
That's a small part of our discussion about this and other issues with Julie Isolde on the program Wednesday. You can hear it all on our website or on our Charlotte Talks podcast. But the key sentence there is they're having, quote, a responsibility to make sure the money is spent in a way that benefits the people. There's the sticky wicket. How do you determine what art benefits the people? And isn't that inherently political? Mary, you're the
Form
politics
commission.
Person.
But also, has anyone, you know, it's always been sticky because when I first moved here, it was interesting how the private sector was always involved in a piece of this. And there was the cooperation with the companies where you would give through your corporation. And that's how they were funded. And it was kind of, they would have the arts groups come to the different companies. So Charlotte has always found these interesting formulas on how you're going to fund the arts. And there's always been these questions about who may be missing out. Are there some of the smaller companies, some of the more minority-based companies missing out, and some of the larger, more ones with a higher profile getting more money?
And although we didn't specifically talk about it the last time we had a discussion on this program about this proposal of the arts being taken over by the city, the debacle of Angels in America came up. That was 25 years ago, and Julie Eisel made mention of the fact that I keep alluding back to something that happened 25 years ago in a very different city. Are we?
I think it's safe to say Charlotte is very different today than it was 25 years ago, just politically. I think if you just look how the city votes in elections, and it is, I'm not saying that there will not be controversies over arts and culture and what is appropriate and what should be funded and shouldn't, but I think it is safe to say this is a very different place than it was back then.
Yeah, but who's to say that the issues that we're facing now, we won't look back on 25 years from now and shake our head at why this was ever a controversy. So I understand why Angels in America is continuously brought up. And, you know, the way that art commissioner was explained to me is it's not supposed to be a city department. So the city, it wouldn't be a city employee overseeing this money. It would be an outside consultant that they haven't identified yet. So that's how it was kind of spun to me.
City Council also got its first look on Monday night at where housing trust fund dollars might be spent for affordable housing. This money will come from the $50 million of affordable housing bonds that voters have said yes to three times in a row. So what projects have been earmarked to receive those funds?
So there's 14 different projects that bring up a total of 1,400 units. Not all of them will be approved. A lot of them hinge on getting tax credits so they're allowed to be built. But, you know, there's some interesting proposals in there. There's a proposal for some senior affordable housing over at the Eastland Mall site. The River District, which is emerging. I know that the city wants to create a new major center out by the Catawba River. There's an affordable housing proposal out there. And we're also looking at renovating already existing affordable housing. There's NOAA's naturally occurring affordable housing. One of the projects is in Uptown Charlotte.
Some council members, including Braxton Winston, pointed out that none of the proposed developments are in the South Charlotte areas, specifically districts 6 and 7.
We will never see the development of affordable housing or diverse price point housing in district 6 and district 7. If city council continues to covet single family exclusionary zoning. It's just a fact of the matter. It's a fact of the map.
He's referring, of course, to one of the snags that the Charlotte 2040 plan has hit over changing zoning to allow multifamily occupancy units in areas formerly zoned exclusively for single family homes. District 2 Representative Malcolm Graham said that the city had to find a way to diversify our housing throughout the community. Will this be what gets the 2040 plan beyond the current snag?
We'll see. I think that Councilman Winston raises a good point. The other point, though, is land costs in District 6 and 7 are astronomical, and that's what's hindering affordable housing being built in those districts at this time.
So we'll keep our eye on that, because this will go on. This discussion will go on for a while.
And it's a national problem, I'll tell you that. Even in some of these northern states like Connecticut, where most of the state is single family homes, and they're all having a problem with affordable housing and crowding people of less means into smaller and smaller areas. It's a crisis nationally.
Well, as COVID restrictions ease, North Carolina has seen an increase in new cases, hospitalizations, and in the percentage of tests coming back positive. This in the first 2 weeks of April after a months-long period of decline. And state epidemiologist Dr. Zach Moore says this is, quote, definitely cause for concern. We had Gibby Harris on the program on Monday. I don't think she expressed that kind of concern level on Monday. Are local officials now concerned about this?
I mean, I think they would like to see the cases remain the same, but if we keep saying concern, the word eventually loses meaning. We are in a much better place right now in terms of vaccines and, levels of COVID in our community than we were 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And I think that, the emphasis right now really has to be making sure people get vaccinated, because that's how we'll get out of this.
Of course, we are in this race against these new, more virulent, more contagious variants, particularly the B.1.1.7 variant. That race is between the virus and the vaccinations. And this week we had a pause in the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine because of some unfortunate side effects. One person actually died from a side effect. Where does that put us in terms of how we're able to get shots into arms?
I think it hurts us in a couple of different ways. One, homebound. It's going to be more complicated now to vaccinate people inside their homes because you're going to have to coordinate going back to them 3 or 4 weeks later. This will hurt college students because, you know, 3 weeks from now, they're taking exams and leaving campus. And now, you know, they can't just get that one shot and be done. And, you know, I don't think it really hurts us from a supply standpoint, though. We still have plenty of Pfizer and Moderna that people just aren't taking as it is. So I don't think it's the end of the world in terms of vaccine supply, but it does make our life more challenging, especially vaccinating some of these more vulnerable communities.
You've seen some health experts get out there to say this is very rare. It's affected just a few women between the ages of 18 and 48 because they realize that folks who are skeptical anyway will a light on this to say, listen, there's something wrong with this vaccine. And that's their fear, that it'll make more people back away from taking any vaccine.
Well, I think the number of people impacted by this is very low. It's like in the tens or teens
out of millions of
people who have gotten the vaccine. But one person, as we said, did die. And what's happening is that there have been blood clots and other rare symptoms associated with the Johnson & Johnson, which is why the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention halted distribution. They have since, I think yesterday, they lengthened their study period to 8 days. So we won't know anything about whether or not this vaccine will be used again for at least 8 days. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And if you're on the list for Johnson & Johnson, obviously you're not going to get the shot today or tomorrow or next week. Can you get on a list for another vaccine?
Yeah, the vaccine is easily available in Mecklenburg County. You can drive over to StarMed right now and get a shot if you want one.
So the problem here is obviously what Mary just said, that this raises hesitancy among some people to get it. There is already hesitancy among great swaths of people. African Americans are hesitant about it. Evangelical Christians are hesitant about it. I read the other day that nearly 50% of Republicans don't want to get this shot. I don't know whether they're hesitant or they just find it politically untenable to get the shot. And then we have healthcare workers who are also reluctant to get the shot, which does not speak well of the shot, or it certainly raises suspicions about shots in general. What might be the impact of this pause in Johnson & Johnson and some of the side effects that we've seen?
Well, yes, people will be skeptical, and that's why you've seen people from the CDC and health experts saying really encouraging people to get these other vaccines, even though, of course, now you have people from Pfizer saying you might need a booster, because this will impact whether the country gets to herd immunity. Every year, even with the flu vaccine, there are a lot of people who don't want to take it, who don't take it. And right now, I hear that the health experts are speculating that we might get to a point where half of the country will take it, which isn't exactly where they want to be. They want it to be higher than that.
And I think, too, you know, what it's going to be interesting to see in North Carolina, across the country, other states, what do governors do, let's say, at the end of June, when everyone who has had an opportunity to take it, it's been many weeks. It's like Joe said, you can get one today. What does that mean when the number of people who are getting it starts really slowing down? What does that mean for mask mandates, closures, restrictions? I think that's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out, because, that it would suggest that the virus will kind of keep rumbling along for months, years. And what do we do?
I probably should not waste the airtime asking this question, Joe, but a couple of weeks ago we talked with you about your efforts to help people get access to vaccinations, and you've become kind of the go-to guy on Twitter about that locally. How is that going? Is it now, you just said you can walk in today and get a shot, so I guess it's easy now, right?
Last Saturday was the first day I noticed that appointments were left on the board, and going forward, it's been the same thing every single day. There is more supply out there now than there is demand for the shots in Mecklenburg County.
Now what will you do? Now that you've solved the problem for everybody and getting access, how will you spend your spare time?
World peace, Joe. I want you to tackle world peace.
All right.
One of the concerns about COVID has been the ease of transmission through the air, particularly in indoor spaces. And experts have recommended upgrades to ventilation systems, particularly in schools. And this week, The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board approved spending nearly $900,000 on a system designed to improve air quality in 39 schools. Sean Turner is the district's interim operations director, and she showed the board one of the devices.
So what does that actually do? Well, it produces millions of positive and negative molecules that attach themselves to air particulates or allergens, dust, viruses.
Sounds like ionization to me, but what are these units, Jonathan, and where are they putting them?
So they're called needlepoint bipolar ionization. And as she said, basically it's installed within the school's HVAC system. They're going to do this at 39 different elementary, middle, and high schools that don't have access to outside air. And so basically, as she said, it creates a lot of positive and negative ions that then attach themselves, in theory, to particulates. They get bigger and are easier to trap by the filter. And so, you know, I was looking this up, and it appears that this is one of the methods that school districts are using across the nation to make the air quality in schools better.
So are we to assume that only 39 schools were deemed to be able to benefit from this or needed this, and that the other schools in the system do not need it? Are we to assume that?
Well, I think, as I said, these were CMS specifically chose these schools, it said, that don't have access to outside air. Looking at the list, most of them are in low-income, socioeconomic neighborhoods. So they tend to be older schools with facilities that aren't as up to date when it comes to HVAC systems. So I don't know, their discussion didn't get into choosing more schools last week, but as it stands now, it's 39 schools.
These units are in use in other districts, at some hospitals, in some airport locations, and elsewhere. But the EPA says this is an, quote, emerging technology with little research available to evaluate its efficacy outside the lab. Considering that, in 10 seconds or less, how should we view this expenditure of $900,000?
With bated breath.
Which is always good, but we have an ionization machine to take care of that bated breath. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is here, our political reporter at WFAE News. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, Channel 9. Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News 1. And Mary C. Curtis, contributor to Roll Call and WCCB-TV, and the host of Roll Call's Equal Time podcast. A couple more quick stories about the schools, Jonathan, including the renaming of Barringer Academic Center or Barringer Elementary. What's the story there?
So people may remember last year when we were having all of these social justice protests that there were a number of schools that people found to be named after either white supremacist families or Confederate generals. At Barringer Academic Center, named after a prominent white supremacist family of the 19th and 20th centuries that's what the school was named after. And so last October, they determined that they wanted to change the name. They included the community. This past week, they selected Charles Parker. The school board voted on three candidates. That Mr. Parker was a former slave who came out of slavery to start schools, affordable housing, churches across the Charlotte area. The hitch in all of that, this was the second voting round for this process. The first time, people may remember, in that community, Judy Williams, who had a relationship with Barringer Academic Center, was the organizer of Mothers of Murdered Offspring. She got the majority of the vote the first time around, but then CMS determined, oh, by human error, we overlooked a requirement, a policy that person has been dead for at least 5 years. And so they ran a second round of voting. Judy Williams' family was obviously not happy with that, because they were
They did everything they were supposed to during that first voting period. They actually did a petition trying to get them to overlook that policy. But in the end, as I mentioned, they chose Charles Parker this week. So that name will be, ultimately, the name of the school will be named after someone who means a little bit more to the community. So ultimately, that's the positive thing.
Another positive thing, last year, students at CMS and around the country actually missed out on proms and graduation ceremonies because of the COVID pandemic and the shutdown. This spring, CMS has announced that graduations will be in person, but there are some limitations. What are they?
Only two guests per student is one of them. So you can go to, I think they're going to be at Bojangles, Ovens, and the Convention Center. But obviously for big families or folks who want a bunch of people there to yell and scream for them, that's going to be a something that'll be a little different.
But they will be streaming these things for the people who cannot get into the locations where they're holding. CMPD yes. has been releasing crime statistics in recent weeks. They tell us the overall crime rate dropped in the first quarter. It's down 16%. From the same period last year, but gun cases are up. And interestingly, they also report the theft of catalytic converters is on the rise. These are the devices that connect between your engine and your muffler and your exhaust pipe that take out all the bad stuff. What areas of town seem to be experiencing these thefts of catalytic converters and why?
Well, they've got good stuff in them. They've got platinum and palladium and all these wonderful things in them. Yeah. And a friend of mine said her dog was barking in the middle of the night. She looked out the window where there are two guys stealing her catalytic converter.
There have been 438 thefts, 438 thefts in the first 3 months of the year, targeting mostly Toyota Priuses, Ford Econoline vans, and Chevy Express trucks. Why those vehicles?
Well, I think a lot has to do with the ease of access of getting to the catalytic converter where it is up under the vehicle. I had a neighbor who had hers stolen. And the interesting thing is if you'll know right away when you turn your and when you try to drive down the street without a catalytic converter, it's the most embarrassing, humiliating sound that...
It's also a very expensive. It's also a very respected. I'm sorry.
Losing your catalytic converter is awful.
It's also a very expensive repair. If it's stolen, it costs thousands of dollars. Here we're talking about. Also, as the legislature is debating a transgender bill in Raleigh, CMPD is telling members of the LGBTQ community to exercise, quote, extreme caution. This after two transgender women have been killed under similar circumstances in Charlotte in just the last 11 days. Are these being targeted? Are these women being targeted, Joe?
So they don't know if the shootings are connected. The killings, I should say, are connected, but they're similar enough that CMPD decided to put out this warning. On Easter Sunday, 29-year-old Jada Peterson was found dead in a motel room, and then yesterday, there was a homicide. CMPD has identified the person, but we're with her name right now just to make sure that we properly identify her by the name that she goes by and not her birth name. But CMPD has released a victim for that most recent killing as well. But certainly, this is very concerning. Black transgender deaths in particular are underreported a lot of times. And we already know that there's been more than a dozen across the country this year, according to HRC.
Voter laws continue to be targets for change in Republican-controlled legislatures around the nation. And here, the debate over photo ID for voters continued in a courtroom where a three-judge panel will consider whether the law we passed in 2018 violates the state constitution. What does that law mandate?
Well, I mean, you really kind of have to go back for North Carolina voting laws to 2013, the Supreme Court in the Shelby v. Holder decision invalidated the portion of the Voting Rights Act that made states with a history of discriminatory voting laws preclear any changes. So we had this huge law that was thrown out of the federal courts for targeting African-American voters with almost surgical precision. And these laws don't have race in them, but it's the disparate impact. So it went to the voters who approved an amendment to the Constitution And that's where we had this law that was passed quickly by Republicans, but while they had enough votes to overturn any veto by Governor Roy Cooper. And they say that this is a better law because certain forms of ID were expanded to put in there. Like before, now you can have college ID and things like that. But it's in the courts because many groups and voters say it is still putting obstacles to folks who are disabled, to the poor, to minorities. And there's this, and it'll probably go to the state Supreme Court and maybe to the federal court and up to the Supreme Court. So I'm not even sure if this will be approved in time for the 2022 midterm elections. But you'll see this. And, you know, the big argument against it is folks are saying it is a solution in search of a problem, that there is voter fraud, which is supposedly the reason you have these laws, is pretty much non-existent. And so the reason is that some politicians want to choose their voters instead of having the voters choose.
And you spoke with Professor Carol Anderson of Emory University about her book, One Person, No Vote, on your Equal Time podcast. She testified against the North Carolina bill. What did she have to say about this?
Well, she points the similarities of this bill to past discriminatory practices in North Carolina throughout its history that have disproportionately been targeted at African-American voters. And, you know, previously when none of them could, when no African-Americans could vote, but still when they had these laws that said that they were on its surface race neutral, but they still impacted African-American and minority voters. And you've had testimony from her and others that show that African-Americans by a larger percentage lack the kinds of ID that are necessary. And even when the state says it's going to provide them at DMVs and elsewhere, it is a hardship oftentimes for African-Americans because of transportation and other issues to get these IDs. And as I said, you know, why are they needed? That's the argument, because they're really, it really is virtually no voter fraud. So the idea of election integrity is not the case.
So a three-judge state panel is considering this. This will whatever the decision is, it will inevitably be appealed, probably to the state Supreme Court and possibly the U.S. Supreme Court. But there have been legal challenges to these similar laws in 34 other states, and they have all survived those challenges. Is this one likely to as well?
Well, I don't want to predict. We'll see. And we've also seen with these voting bills are across the country now that we've seen corporations get into it. So they're coming out with statements for open voting and for voting rights. So we'll see what Republicans, it's primarily Republican driven in these states, will do about these voting laws.
Yesterday. I was just going to say, Mike, that quick, that on this law, a federal court has already given a green light to this photo ID law in North Carolina. So there were kind of two lawsuits, a federal lawsuit, which has been resolved, and now we've got this state lawsuit going as well.
So yesterday, Thursday, we got our first look at what $50 million will buy when it comes to renovations at Bank of America Stadium for the Charlotte FC pro soccer team. What is in store? What's the facelift going to be? Anybody? Joe, go ahead.
It's, you know, new entrances, new locker rooms. Aesthetically, Bank of America Stadium will be more pleasing for soccer matches. And it will be, it'll look great. I mean, it's $50 million. It's going to look great. But
yeah, they're putting a 210-foot LED screen out in front of the east entrance, moving the Black Panthers. They're moving those a little further out, I guess, so you can see the screen on which they'll put commercials and plays and promos and things like that. And they also announced yesterday where you will be able to see these soccer games on TV. Yes. Joe, where might that be?
Channel 9, as well as TV64 and Telemundo Charlotte. So we're the official partner, and the great news is you can watch it free over the air with an antenna. So, you know, you won't get into the issue that's happening with, like, the Hornets right now, where so many people can't watch their games because of the dispute between Bally Sports and the various streaming providers. So always will be free over the air with an antenna.
Yes, and at free high definition TV, free over the air with an antenna, looks better than it does on satellite or cable, I got to tell you. So, but I'm sorry, Jonathan. There was a shocking scene straight out of a Breaking Bad in Alamance County this week when a popular Union County teacher and coach, a Spanish teacher and coach, was killed in a shootout with a Mexican drug cartel. Alamance County Sheriff Terry Johnston described the scene this way.
Numerous guns were used, firearms was used. You could tell it was almost like an old Western shootout.
The teacher who died there is Barney Harris, a high school Spanish teacher, basketball coach at Union Academy, a charter school in Monroe, well-loved, respected, who evidently led a completely hidden, dark life. What else do we know about this guy?
Apparently, he and his brother-in-law went to go rob this cartel in Green Level, Alamance County. What concerned me was apparently he was wearing a bulletproof vest that did not work with the type of ammo that was used in the shooting. Whatever that means, that sounds very concerning.
It means the drug cartel's not messing around.
Yeah, it's one of those concerning, it's one of those stories that you just keep reading and reading, and you're like, you just, your jaw just continues to drop.
You know, what blew my mind was the fact that this is the Sinaloa cartel that has connections to El Chapo, who is in, you know, at the Supermax prison. But still, I mean, this was a high level cartel that this teacher had some sort of connection with.
And he had allegedly come to rob the cartel, and it's a robbery that went awry. And there was an 18-year-old young man who was found bound with two bullets in his head. Do we know who is allegedly charged with firing those shots?
They charged his brother-in-law with murder, the murder of that.
Was the 18-year-old a member of the cartel, or was he one
allegedly,
of the...
Allegedly, yes. Allegedly. And that's one of the reasons why Sheriff Johnson is worried about retaliation.
Well, and also what makes this concerning is not that this is a one-off incident. It is evidently, and we've talked about this before, North Carolina is perfectly geographically set up to be a great place for drug and sex trafficking because of our interstate highway system.
And especially that location in Alamance County where Interstate 85 and Interstate 40 intersect. And so it creates, the coverage on this was just amazing that I saw how it, you know, 85 connects down to Atlanta, which is a major hub. And then Atlanta connects down to cities like New Orleans and Texas and Miami. And it's just, it's amazing how all of that funnels its way up through our, you know, interstates by way of 85. And this apparently, like I said, this location in Alamance County, that's one thing that sheriff is specifically dealing with because of its location.
The notorious darling of Wall Street turned swindler died this week, Bernie Madoff, at the age of 82 in Butner. That's a prison in North Carolina. It was the largest Ponzi scheme in history involving billions of dollars. He was sentenced to life, and that ended this week, and that's all we have to say about that. But in the legislature, they are considering a bill to fix time. They want to make daylight saving time permanent in the state. What do they see as the benefits? I have less than a minute. What do they see as the benefits of this?
I know that it would benefit farmers, for one.
Even in the winter?
Apparently, it would give them longer days to harvest, and it's really confusing.
And Charlotte is a major hub for American Airlines, and time is critical to airlines. It's critical to broadcast networks. It's critical to a lot of things. Have they taken that into consideration? Because if we stay on daylight saving time and the rest of the nation is on standard time in the wintertime, what does that do to airline schedules?
It makes it very confusing.
And for those people who have alarm clocks and thermostats that automatically know when it's time to go back to daylight saving time or standard time, what happens to those devices, one wonders. Steve Harrison, Joe Bruno, Jonathan Lowe, Mary C. Curtis, thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.